This morning's scripture is being taken from the book of Galatians, chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. That is Galatians chapter 6.
Genesis.
Oh, okay, never mind. Genesis chapter 6.
I might have Galatians on there, but it's definitely...
It's Genesis? Okay. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. And if you're in Genesis, it reads as follows. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they choose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, and his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, and I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of God, in the eyes of the Lord.
Well, good to see everyone is out this morning. Beautiful day. This particular week, I was out and about, and practically everyone is commenting about the weather, as we typically do, but especially about how mild this winter has been. I hope we're not talking ourselves in for a beast of March, but it has been you guys are experiencing really an Alabama winter. I don't know if you know that or not, but this is about what we have in North Alabama. Some cold days, but you get a reprieve from it. Matter of fact, they're having more snow and cold down there than we are up here. My mom the other day called her on the phone, and she said, how's the weather? And I said, oh, it's beautiful. It's about 60 out there. And she then told me it was snowing in Hartsel there in North Alabama. But such is life, right? But anyway, glad to see you out this morning. Enjoy this beautiful Lord's Day. And a couple of additional announcements, and then I'll get right into the lesson. One, and Edward, correct me if I'm wrong, Beth had both an infection and blood clot in her arm. I think that kind of went back and forth yesterday, but note that in your bulletin. And also, if you're looking for Wes this morning, he's preaching in West Virginia, Morgantown, West Virginia, so that's where he is. Over the next, today and next week, this couple of weeks, I want to look at the story of Noah, as you can see above me here. I want to talk about the story primarily from the book of Genesis, although this morning I will go outside and look at some other references as well. But I especially want to be concerned with just some of the questions, some of the commentary, skepticism, if you will, that is right now very popular about the whole story of Noah. You may or may not realize, but you would find this interesting, some of you especially. You might want to go home and note some of this. There has been quite a bit of, in the last 10 years, quite a bit of research that's been done about various, as they call them, mega floods. Not global floods, such as the Bible speaks of, the global flood in the time of Noah, but mega floods in the sense that in different parts of the world, and I find this very interesting, started noticing this, as I say, about 10 years ago, there were at least three and maybe four concurrent studies in different parts of the world. One of them was in the Mediterranean. Won't get sidetracked into that. But the point being, these were mega floods. Not just your typical floods as we have them from time to time, but super floods that were maybe caused by a giant tidal wave coming in, maybe a break off of a piece of the earth, a massive volcano eruption or whatever.
And these don't happen, obviously, very often, but when they do, they can cause tsunamis far more than what we saw a few years ago, even that were so destructive in over in Indonesia. But evidence showing that there were, in different parts of the world, mega floods. Remember, Montel and I were watching one of these documentaries on one of these, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and I turned to her and I said, you know, eventually they're going to study themselves into realizing the earth has left evidence of a global flood. Well, that's kind of come about. And all the evidence is pointing to, someone has begun to hypothesize, that what if these floods were, if not at the same time, but were generally at the same time, would it be possible to have a global flood? And with that, there's been the resurgence of the biblical story and other myths as these people look at them. I'm not saying, if you're hearing this on CD or on the internet, I put my little fingers up for quotation marks. Not myths, but people view them as such. But the whole question of could there have been a global flood? And I think that's going to be interesting as that whole scenario develops. Well, it brings you to a lot of questions about what God says in the book of Genesis. So I want to look at it. The story of Noah. Let's start by asking some questions or maybe just noting some things. What do we know of Noah? I mean, what does the Bible tell us? Not a great deal. We know far more, for example, about the Apostle Paul or Joseph or Daniel. But what do we know of Noah? Well, we know, if you'll turn with me to Genesis 5, that Noah was the last in a line of godly people. And if you'll notice the way I put it, a line of godly people living in a world given to sin and especially to violence. If you look at Genesis 5, in fact, if you were to go back to Genesis 4, you would see the descendants of Cain. Percy read a passage a moment ago from Genesis 6, and I believe that is not talking about angels and human beings and some kind of hybrid half angel, half human, as some people do. I don't believe that at all. I think it speaks of those who are ungodly and those who are godly. It speaks of perhaps the line of Cain and his fellow brothers and sisters, but Cain especially becoming a ruling class of people, and the line of Seth, who was a godly line. And as you trace this, and I'm not going to get deep into that, but as you trace this through Genesis 5, that line of Seth dwindles, and I don't mean the whole line does, but as far as remaining godly, it dwindles all the way down, as you could see from the end of Percy's reading, only Noah is left. God destroys the earth in for its violence as much as anything. If you look at Genesis 6, you can see, for example, that God tells him, verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. If you notice again that when it talks about Noah, he said, I've seen you righteous, chapter 7, verse 1, I've seen you righteous in this generation. All of that's pointing to the fact that he's the last one. Only Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, chapter 6 and verse 8. So what we see is a line of godly people dwindling down to just Noah and obviously eventually his family, his wife, his sons, and their wives. If you'll read with me in Genesis 5, you can see as this line comes down through Enoch, who lived 65 years, begat Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years and begot sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were only, and I stress that because this is at a time when his son will live to be 969. But he lived 365 years on the earth. And verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And Methuselah lived 187 years, begat Lamech. And he lived, after that, 782 years, and all the days of Methuselah were 969 years. Now, I'll point that out. I'll come back to that next Sunday morning, but I'm going to leave it at that for right now. And he died. And then Lamech. Who is Lamech? Well, he is Noah's father. Lamech would have been born into a world that was fast becoming corrupt and violent. Perhaps there is worldwide war. Maybe that's what's meant by it. Might not be, but it's possible. But he has this son Noah, and he puts a lot of hope in Noah. Notice verse 29. He called his name Noah, saying, "This is he." The word means something like to have rest or comfort. And he said, "This is this same or this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." I've often wondered about that. And I've wondered if God meant this when he cursed the ground in the days of Adam, that he meant that the earth would, in fact, be like this, or if just that in Lamech's day he's taking it like that, that part of the curse of man, being driven out of the garden, living on his own, all of that kind of thing, that it has come to this, a world of violence. Doesn't matter. Whatever reason, this is what we know. Noah is born into a world that's very corrupt. Noah is born into a world of violence, a world that is given to sin. Notice again Percy's reading in chapter 6. Notice that man is only concerned with the physical things, beautiful women, marrying beautiful women, being renowned, you know, his pride. The idea of renown is often used for a warrior that advances himself or esteems himself and all of that. Mighty men of old, verse 3. All of those are pointing to war and the idea of being a soldier and all of that. That's what man is concerned with. And into that world lives and is born and lived Noah. We know Noah was a righteous man. You have I seen righteous, chapter 7, verse 1. Ezekiel, many, many years later, thousands of years later, will note righteous, great righteous people. And he will take note of Job, for example, and Noah. Noah was a righteous man who delivered his own soul by his righteousness. You can turn and read that. I'm not going to turn and read those verses. But Noah is renowned for his righteousness and delivering his soul by that. We might ask the question, was he a perfect man then? Of all the people in the world of sinners? No, he wasn't. And we see in chapter 9, even after the flood, one of the first things he does, you can see in verse 21 there, is he plants a vineyard and he harvests the grapes and he makes wine and he gets drunk. He's not a perfect man, but he is a good man. He made a bad mistake there, but he's a good man. And his righteousness delivers his soul. Now, let's continue to ask some questions about him. What else do we know? What do we know of Noah? Well, we also know from what the Bible tells us, he was a preacher. If you'll turn over to 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5, not only was he righteous, but he was a preacher of righteousness. He was, and I'm going to come back to this passage, so I won't turn there right now, but at the end of the lesson this morning, I'm going to look back at 1 Peter 3. He became the voice of Christ. The voice of Christ preaching to those who were disobedient in his day. So Noah was a preacher. We often know of Noah. And if you've seen this trailer for this movie that's coming out shortly, Brother White, and it kind of sticks out of my mind. But if you've seen that trailer, it starts off, there must be something there where he's teaching a Sunday school class and he's asked the question of the children, what do you know about Noah? He built that boat. And that's right. But the Bible teaches us not only was he a boat builder, but he was also a preacher. He was preaching to these people in his day to turn from their sins and to turn to God. He was telling them what was right, and of course they should have heeded it. We also know that he endured. I want you to turn over to Luke 17, and Jesus uses Noah for an example, and perhaps an example to you and me. When he says in Luke 17, and drop down with me to verse 26. He says, destruction really has always come. He cites Sodom and Gomorrah. He cites the days of Noah. Destruction has always come. Judgment has always come to people and sort of caught them by surprise. But it really shouldn't be that way. Look at Luke 17 and verse 26. He says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. And he just describes common life. These are the things people are concerned with. They did eat. They drank. They married wives. They were given in marriage. Until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. That's life, isn't it? I mean, we're concerned with dinner today. We're concerned with where are we having dinner. Are we going out? Are we eating at home? If we're eating at home, what are we having? If we go out, what's on the menu? And it really consumes our thoughts. If we're getting married, we're thinking, if we're not getting married, we're thinking about getting married. If we have someone we're going to marry, we think about the marriage. If we don't, we think about getting someone to marry, etc., etc. Our relationships consume our lives. And what happens if we're not careful? Those things of life. Now, they're important. If you don't eat, you die. If you don't drink some water, you die. And from an emotional standpoint, perhaps, if you don't get someone to love and you don't get married, you emotionally die. I understand they're important things. But if you're not careful, they consume your life. You get to the point where, yeah, there's that nut over there building that boat, and he's preaching about a flood coming, or he's preaching about the destruction of the world, and I don't have time for that. I need to concern myself with what I'm eating today and tomorrow and next week. Or I've got a marriage to think about, or a wedding to think about. I don't have time for that. If you're not careful, that'll be your whole life. Your whole life will be consumed with the things of life, and it will always be something. You will always either be eating or drinking or marrying or giving in marriage, or you've got this event or this job or that job. And if you're not careful, the sum total of your life will be those things. And the destruction will come. The flood will come, or the end of time in our case will come, and it will come in upon us suddenly, or death will come in upon us suddenly, and we will have to face judgment, and all we will have in our life are all these things. Our life will be a series of events, one meal to the next, etc., and we weren't ready. But we know that Noah endured all of that. I'm sure that with having three sons and they all three got married and he had to eat just like you have to eat, he had to be concerned with those things. But he found time for two things. One, to preach righteousness. You know, we have this program with these little cards. Several people this morning asked for them. And I know people are getting them. Even little children to some of our oldest members are grabbing a handful of cards, passing them out. This is just simply to say to somebody, just take a moment of your life and say to someone, think about something more important. Have you considered your spiritual options? Noah concerned himself with preaching the truth. And Noah concerned himself with preparing for the destruction of the world. Judgment. And you and I have to do the same. He endured while the world ignored. And that's our duty. Noah was saved. I said I would come back to this passage. But Noah was saved, he and his family, through the same water, and we'll look at this, that destroyed the world. I'll come back to that point. Edward, we were talking about this just a couple of days ago. But we'll come back to this. Now, we also know, finally, that God gave Noah the commandment to build the ark. And this gets us into looking at some of the skepticism and the questions and all of that. We're going to concern ourselves with just this one this morning. God gave Noah the commandment to build the ark to escape that destruction of the world. The instructions were very explicit. Do it just like this. Look at chapter 6, if you will. Noah, verse 14, make thee an ark of gopher, or some of your translations say acacia wood. But it's very explicit. I don't know exactly what gopher wood or acacia wood. I don't know if it was the same kind of plant. You know, the geography of the world changed and so forth. Noah would have known. Make an ark of this exact kind of wood. And the instructions get very explicit. Make it just so high, just so long, just so wide. Put a window here, a door there. Pitch it within, without, etc. You see this in the verses that follow, and we'll focus in on some of those in a moment. But the Bible tells us, if you look down at verse 22, of all these explicit commands, thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. Look down at verse 5. Noah did, chapter 7, verse 5. Noah did according to all the Lord commanded him. That's what's important. That's the example. I'm not being commanded to build an ark, but there are other things that I'm commanded to do. I'm commanded to do some very specific things. We just took the Lord's Supper. There are very explicit commands. Take this unleavened bread, this fruit of the vine, and honor the body and blood of Jesus. We did that. And have a prayer that thanks God, bless the bread, thank God for it, thank God for the fruit of the vine. We did that. We've come together on the first day of the week. We followed exactly the apostles' examples example in Acts chapter 20. We do it repeatedly, as 1 Corinthians 11 shows us. They're very explicit commandments. Not everybody in the world follows them so closely. Not everybody in the world is concerned with doing the details exactly as God gives them. But notice the details here. Noah was commended for following the details. God told him how long to make the boat. God told him how wide to make the boat. It wasn't left to his discretion. Just like honoring Jesus' body and blood is not left to our discretion. When I was in school, one of my professors said, it doesn't matter what you use, as long as you just remember the body and blood of Jesus. So someone asked him, would it be all right to have hamburgers and Coke? And he said, sure. He said, I don't care if you use Coca-Cola or water or whatever you use. It doesn't matter. Well, God has been explicit. God has said, use this. God said to Noah, make the ark of gopher wood. It wasn't left to his discretion to say, I think oak would be better. Or redwood or whatever it might be. He was told what to do, and he did it. That's a great example to you and I. Notice also, Noah found grace, favor, in the eyes of the Lord. The favor is found with God, and the Bible shows this in so many examples. We won't take time to look at them this morning, but so many examples teach us that we are favored, and that's what grace means. We're favored by God because we listen to God, because we do what God says do. Why did Noah find grace in the eyes of the Lord when no one else did? Because it was Noah that was doing right. You have I seen right or righteous in this generation. Does God take notice of you? Does God look down here on this earth full of people and look at Michael White individually and say to Michael White, you are doing right or you are doing wrong, and I know that? And the answer is yes to all of us. Just as he did with Noah, so he does with you. And your name is either recorded in the book of life because you do what's right, or it is excluded from the book of life because you don't. God takes notice. I don't just kind of slip by, slide by, you know, get in under the radar, whatever term you want to use. God takes complete notice. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, with today's skepticism, and let's just broach this, and we're going to come back to it next Sunday. But with today's skepticism, there are a number of questions arise about Noah, and the ark in particular, and the whole global flood and destruction of the world. You know, people ask questions like, how big was the ark? And usually they're asking it for various reasons. I mean, first of all, could Noah build it? But secondly, could it carry, for example, a pair of all the animals of the world? One of the questions I ask you on the bulletin, I want you to be thinking about this for next Sunday, and I'm going to get into this for some of the children here especially. Were there dinosaurs on the ark? That's a big question that people ask. Could Noah and his family care for all those animals? And if you'll notice in the question about the dinosaurs, incidentally, for you to be thinking about, you know, the whole idea is that dinosaurs were here, came and gone before man evolved from that little rat-like mammal that was able to, the popular theory today, escape all that destruction above ground from that asteroid. That little mole-like mammal that burrowed under the ground and so forth. That's supposed to be what we evolved from. Eventually became an ape and eventually became us. Now, this would presuppose that God created dinosaurs and man at the same time. We're going to talk about a little bit of that and consider that question. But if so, What about those gigantic dinosaurs being on the ark? We'll look at that as well. Could Noah and his family care for all those animals? I mean, you got a pair at least of all the animals of the earth. How do eight people take care of all those animals? And we'll answer some of those questions, or at least offer some things to think about. And finally, there's this question. I've heard this several times. Could all that water, remember the Bible teaches it covers the highest mountain on the earth, could all that water come from 40 days of raining? I mean, I think it's rained around here 40 days in a row before, and it hasn't flooded the earth. So could all that water come from 40 days of rain? So we want to take a look at that. But let's talk about the ark. God commanded Noah to build the ark to exact specifications. If you'll notice, in verses 14, especially verse 15, he tells him to make it so many cubits long, so many cubits wide. What is a cubit? A cubit is generally regarded to be the length of a man's forearm. Go to the back of your elbow, go down at least to the end of your wrist. Some would have it going to the end of the palm. But that length is a cubit. Now, obviously, it's different on every single person. Generally, a tall man was chosen. Egyptian records show this. An Egyptian cubit is, at different times, 20.6 or 20.8 inches. But generally, a cubit is regarded, and the so-called standard for it was about 18 inches. Now, I would suggest to you, if you're looking at this, these people live a long time, and they're big people. Some have said, you know, if there were giants on the earth in that day, how tall could Noah have been? Would he have been a little short 5-foot man? He might have been. But could he have been more on the order of a 6.5 to 7-foot tall man? He might have been. And what would be the length of here to here? Well, we're going to use a conservative estimate. I just want you to understand that. The boat could be bigger than what we're going to say, but we're going to use this standard 18 inches. 300 cubits long, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Build an ark to exact specifications. And that ain't it. Well, what that is a cruise ship. In fact, it is the Norwegian Cruise Line's MS Skyward. And I chose this cruise ship because as you're looking at that beautiful thing, incidentally, I don't know if it's still over there, but a couple of weeks ago there was a cruise ship moored in New York. There probably was one there all the time. But it's about the same size, and it's massive. If you ever want to be impressed with how big the ark was, go over there to the harbor and just stand near one of those things, unless you've been on one. If you've been on one, you know exactly what I'm saying. But this particular ship, the MS Skyward, is about the exact same dimensions, length and width, as Noah's Ark. Now, I don't know if you can see very well or not, but I want you to look at this picture, and if you'll look down in the bottom right corner where they're loading this thing, if you'll notice, there is a tractor trailer parked beside that ship. And I chose this picture because if you've ever been in a tractor trailer, and I've loaded and unloaded plenty of them, I mean, it's a lot of room in a tractor trailer. I want you to look at how small that thing is against this ship. You start getting an idea of the size of a 450 by, you know, et cetera, in verse 15. You start getting an idea of how big the ark really was. Now, it was probably more, let's note this. The ark is supposed to have been the largest sea vessel ever built to the late 1800s when they started making them out of iron. And, of course, they make them a lot bigger because iron is more sturdy than wood. But what's important is that it's barge-like length. If you begin to study it, here's a wooden vessel like a barge, for that's what God describes. Make it so long, so wide, so high. Make it 3 stories. And each story, obviously, each level, each floor would be filled. And if you put a vessel like that full into the water, a great deal of it is going to submerge. And it's going to be like a barge is. Now, if you've ever seen a barge going down a river, a barge is a huge vessel, but the majority of it is underwater with all the cargo. And what you really see, what it looks like, is this thin little deck floating across the top of the water. Shipbuilders note that with a width ratio of 6 to 1, and all of that weight submerging a substantial portion in the water, it would be virtually impossible to roll it over. If you remember, and I'm sure you've seen on science fiction movies or whatever, or they'll depict when a tidal wave hits a ship, Poseidon adventure type thing. Most of that ship is above water, and the water hits it and it rolls it over. But a barge, no matter how violent the storm, it just virtually is impossible to roll the thing over. God had him make a very stable vessel. Very practical, as we're going to talk about next Sunday, but very stable. And modern shipbuilders take note of that 6-to-1 ratio and how perfect really that design is. Now, it probably looked more like that. That's a model. And it is a humongous model, but this was a model that was built out in the middle of nowhere, really. But it was built next to, for comparison, a regular one-story house, a ranch-like house like we normally have down south. And you can see the comparison, how big this thing is, just compared with a normal family-sized dwelling. And it probably looks like that, very rectangular and cubical. Now, I'll close with this, but let's just start getting in our minds the idea of size. As you're thinking about filling it up with all those animals and everything, we'll look at next Sunday. The total available floor space on the ark would have been about 33,000 square feet per story, or literally 101,250 square feet. That's a lot. That's about 21 and a half standard-sized basketball courts of floor space. You ever played basketball, run up and down that floor 2 or 3 times, you realize how long that floor really is. 21 and a half standard-sized basketball courts. The total cubic volume would have been 1,518,750 cubic feet. Now, the way that I'm getting that is simply length times width times height. But that equals the capacity of over 229 modern railroad 50-foot boxcars. In other words, if you ever watch a freight train, we don't have a lot of them around here, but if you watch a freight train and you ever get stuck at a crossing waiting for one to pass, there can be literally hundreds of cars on that thing. It goes on and on and on forever. 229 of those. In fact, this particular boxcar is about that size. If you've ever been, this is one of the most popular in the country, this rail box, yellow box car. It's massive when you stand next to it. Think about 229 of those things to fill. When we start talking about space, we talk about how big the ark is. I just want you to let that rest and start thinking about in terms of, well, okay, how big were the dinosaurs and all of that kind of thing. And I know some of you kids especially are really interested in that, so we're going to come back and talk about it. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, I want you to turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 3. Noah preached the truth in his day. I picture, and this may not be right, but I picture it like this. I see this man out in the middle of nowhere. He would not have had to been on the sea. It wasn't going to matter. The water was going to rise wherever he was. And I can see him out in the middle of nowhere building this massive boat, this massive barge-like vessel. It would have taken years and years. If you remember Percy's reading, God gave him 120. It would have taken him years, perhaps the whole 120. I can see him building, and I can see his sons joining him as they're old enough and they're building. And it would become an attraction, you know, kind of like if you've ever seen the cowboy over in New York City. He's an oddball. Everybody goes over there to look at him. I can see Noah becoming like that in his day. Someone to laugh at, someone to point a finger at. And Noah's not just building and hammering away and sawing away and so forth. He's preaching. I see him kind of combining the two. I see him standing up on that ark. Hey, Noah, why are you doing that? Well, let me tell you. You need to be preparing. God is going to send the destruction of the world. I hear him teaching people and talking to them, and they're laughing at him. They certainly don't accept the truth. No one responds. No one listens. And of course, they don't listen right up until the day, just like Jesus said, that the flood came. And then everyone scrambles and tries to listen, but it's too late. The Bible tells us in 1 Peter 3, if you notice, Christ, verse 18, went and preached to the spirits in prison, verse 19. Who are they? Well, he tells you in verse 20, those spirits in prison were the disobedient people in the days of Noah. Now, how is Christ preaching to them? Through Noah. Just like Christ preaches to the world today, you are, as the songs say, and we sing them sometimes, you are the voice of Christ. Christ has no hands but your hands. He has no, etc., etc. You preach Jesus to a world that needs to listen. And perhaps you're laughed at sometimes. Someone makes fun of you. Why do you go to church all the time? Why do you believe in that book of fairy tales? Why do you believe those things that people say aren't true and all of that? Maybe people say those kinds of things, but you endure. Now listen to this passage. But sometime were disobedient when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. God saved Noah. He could have saved him in a number of ways, couldn't he? He could have saved him by just simply reaching down and holding him up in the air while the flood raged on the earth. He could have done that. He could have transported him to another planet if he chose to do that. But God chose to save Noah through the same water by which he destroyed the world. And God chooses, verse 21, to save you the same way. It is an antitype, the light figure, whereunto even baptism, the same water that will destroy the majority of the world because they refuse to obey God and be baptized, is the water that will save you. That's not the putting away the filth of the flesh. It's not just washing your physical dirt off of you. It is the appeal to God for a clear conscience. Just like Noah appealed to God for a clear conscience because he was willing to preach when people laughed, and because he was willing to build that ark to those exact specifications, God saved him. And because his family was willing to enter that ark with him and trust, have faith in God, God saved them. But because most people refuse, they're destroyed by that water. That same water through which God saved them, and that water through which God saves us by being baptized. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, obey God. Have faith in the Lord that what He has said, He will save you if you will believe and you will be baptized. Be like Noah. Trust God and obey God. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?